So for this retreat, I wanted to try to do something a little bit different. And generally speaking, I try to do something a bit different at every retreat. I was, a couple of years ago, an Aboriginal elder told me that my totem is the kangaroo. And the distinctive feature of the kangaroo is kangaroos can only go forwards. They can't go backwards. One of the few animals that can't walk backwards. So that's me. I can only go forwards and I can't go back. So I don't like to do the same thing again and again. And so what I'd like to do is to present the retreat in a slightly different way every time. And for this one, I thought that I would like to use the, as a framework for the retreat, I'd like to use the life of the Buddha. So what I'll do is that during the retreat each day, we'll go through the life of the Buddha, and we'll talk about a different aspect of the life of the Buddha, both as history and as mythology, that is to say as fact and as sacred story, because both of those things are meaningful and both of those things are part of the heritage of the Buddhist tradition. In the Buddhist tradition, the life of the Buddha is one of the fundamental ways that the Buddha's teachings are brought across. Why? Because they can frame the Dhamma within an actual human life rather than within just a theory or an idea. And so you'll find if you go to different Buddhist countries and different temples and things like that, you'll find that the events in the life of the Buddha are told again and again and again in the murals and the Dhamma talks and all kinds of things. Now, I'm not planning on doing too much of a kind of detailed sort of textual or historical analysis of this, I'm sure you'll be pleased to know, but I'll just give you a general background. Okay, so the Buddha lived about 2,500 years ago, and he was born in northern India in a place called Lumbini, and was grew up in a town called Kapilavastu near the Nepalese border in northern India. At 29 he went forth, spent 6 years practicing, and then became enlightened, became the Buddha. He then spent the remaining 45 years of his life teaching Dhamma before passing away at 80 in Kusinara. Oh, I'm sorry, I didn't realize I was so late. First I was too late, now I'm too early. This is what the Buddha said, in the two extremes. Anyway, so that's a general summary of the Buddha's life. Then after he died, his life story was, or his teachings were memorized by his students, passed down through the generations. Eventually, people got around to writing biographies of the Buddha, and they wrote very extensive texts, which began as compilations, so people getting together different stories, different verses or events, narratives, and sort of clumping them all together, and we have a certain text like that, and then gradually they sort of sifted it out and reshaped it, and by the time about 500 years after the Buddha, 500-600 years, one of the greatest poets of ancient India, in fact one of the greatest poets of all time, by the name of Ashvaghosa, wrote a book called The Life of the Buddha, where by that time the Buddha's life story was like perfectly cast as a literary event, as a classic verse account of his life. So the earliest records that we have of the Buddha's life are found in what we call the suttas, or the early Buddhist texts, and that's where I'll be primarily basing my account on. And as we shall see, not everything in the early Buddhist text is necessarily historical. In fact, there's some degree of elaboration and myth-making even within those very early texts, but it's usually fairly, not too difficult to see where those elaborations are taking place. So let us begin with the Buddha's birth. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to read for you from the Majjhima Nikaya. This is sutta number 123 of the Majjhima Nikaya. For those of you who wanted references, here we go. Majjhima Nikaya 123, and this is the Acharya Abhuta Sutta. incredible and amazing. So I'll just read the sutta to begin with, and I'll give some commentary on it afterwards. So I have heard, at one time the Buddha was staying near Savatthi in Jetta's grove in Atapindika's monastery. Then after the meal, on return from alms round, several senior mendicants sat together in the pavilion, and this discussion came up among them. It's incredible, reverence. It's amazing, the power and might of a realized one. For he is able to know the Buddhas of the past, who have become completely extinguished, cut off proliferation, cut off the track, finished off the cycle and transcended suffering. He knows the caste they were born in and also their names, clans, conduct, teaching, wisdom, meditation and freedom. When they said this, Venerable Ananda said, the realized ones are incredible, reverence, and they have incredible qualities. They're amazing and they have amazing qualities. But this conversation among those mendicants was left unfinished. Then in the late afternoon, the Buddha came out of retreat, went to the assembly hall, sat down on the seat spread out and addressed the mendicants. Mendicants, what were you sitting talking about just now? What conversation was unfinished? So the mendicants told him what they had been talking about when the Buddha arrived. The Buddha said, so, Ananda, say some more about the incredible and amazing qualities of the realized one. So the Buddha didn't have any problems with self-confidence. Sir, says Ananda, I have heard and learned this in the presence of the Buddha, mindful and aware. The being intent on awakening was reborn in the host of joyful gods. This I remember as an incredible quality of the Buddha. I have learned this in the presence of the Buddha. Mindful and aware, the being intent on awakening remained in the host of joyful gods. This too I remember as an incredible quality of the Buddha. I have learned this in the presence of the Buddha. For the whole of that life, the being intent on awakening remained in the host of joyful gods. Also I learned this, mindful and aware, the being intent on awakening passed away from the host of joyful gods and was conceived in his mother's womb. I've learned this in the presence of the Buddha. When the being intent on awakening passes away from the host of joyful gods, he is conceived in his mother's womb. And then, in this world with its gods, Maras and Brahmas, this population with its ascetics and Brahmins, gods and humans, an immeasurable, magnificent light appears, surpassing the glory of the gods. Even in the boundless desolation of interstellar space, so utterly dark that even the light of the moon and the sun, so mighty and powerful, makes no impression, an immeasurable, magnificent light appears, surpassing the glory of the gods. And even the beings reborn there recognize each other by that light. So it seems other sentient beings have been reborn here. And this galaxy shakes and rocks and trembles, and an immeasurable, magnificent light appears in the world, surpassing the glory of the gods. This too I remember as an incredible quality of the Buddha. I have learned this in the presence of the Buddha. When the being intent on awakening is conceived in his mother's belly, four deities approach to guard the four directions, so that no human or non-human or anyone at all shall harm the being intent on awakening or its mother. I've learned this, when the being intent on awakening is conceived in his mother's belly, she becomes naturally ethical. She refrains from killing living creatures, stealing, sexual misconduct, lying, and alcoholic drinks that cause negligence. When the being intent on awakening is conceived in his mother's belly, she no longer feels sexual desire for men, and she cannot be violated by a man of lustful intent. When the being intent on awakening is conceived in his mother's belly, she obtains the five kinds of sensual stimulation and amuses herself, supplied and provided with them. When the being intent on awakening is conceived in his mother's belly, no afflictions beset her. She is happy and free of bodily fatigue. And she sees the being intent on awakening in her womb, complete with all his various parts, not deficient in any faculty. Suppose there were a beryl gem that was naturally beautiful, eight-faceted, well-worked, and it was strung with a thread of blue, yellow, red, white, or golden brown. And someone with good eyesight were to take it in their hand and examine it. This beryl gem is naturally beautiful. In the same way, when the being intent on awakening is conceived in his mother's belly, no afflictions beset her. She's happy and free of bodily fatigue, and she sees the being intent on awakening in her womb, complete with all his various parts, not deficient in any faculty. I've learned this in the presence of the Buddha. 7 days after the being intent on awakening is born, the mother passes away and is reborn in the host of joyful gods. I've learned this. Other women carry the infant in the womb for 9 or 10 months before giving birth. Not so the mother of the being intent on awakening. She gives birth after exactly 10 months. I've learned this. Other women give birth while sitting or lying down. Not so the mother of the being intent on awakening. She only gives birth standing up. I've learned this. When the being intent on awakening emerges from his mother's womb, gods receive him first, then humans. I've learned this. When the being intent on awakening emerges from his mother's womb, before he reaches the ground, 4 deities receive him and place him before his mother, saying, "Rejoice, O queen, an illustrious son is born to you." And I've learned this. When the being intent on awakening emerges from his mother's womb, he emerges already clean, unsoiled by waters, mucus, blood, or any other kind of impurity, pure and clean. Suppose a jewel treasure was placed on a cloth from Kasi. The jewel would not soil the cloth, nor would the cloth soil the jewel. Why not? Because of the cleanliness of them both. I've learned this. When the being intent on awakening emerges from his mother's womb, 2 streams of water appear in the sky, one cool, one warm, for bathing the being intent on awakening and his mother. I've learned this. As soon as he's born, the being intent on awakening stands firm with his own feet on the ground. Facing north, he takes 7 strides with a white parasol held above him, surveys all quarters, and makes this dramatic statement, "I am the foremost in the world. I am the eldest in the world. I am the best in the world. This is my last rebirth. Now there are no more future lives." I have learned this in the presence of the Buddha. When the being intent on awakening emerges from his mother's womb, then, in this world with its gods, with its Maras and Brahmas, with its population, with its ascetics and Brahmans, gods and humans, an immeasurable, magnificent light appears, surpassing the glory of the gods. Even in the boundless desolation of interstellar space, so utterly dark that even the light of the moon and sun, so mighty and powerful, makes no impression. An immeasurable, magnificent light appears, surpassing the glory of the gods. And the sentient beings reborn there recognize each other by that light, saying, "So it seems, other sentient beings have been reborn here." And this galaxy shakes and rocks and trembles. This too I remember as an incredible and amazing quality of the Buddha. And the Buddha responds to Ananda's statement. "So, Ananda, you should also remember this as an incredible and amazing quality of the Realized One. It's that the Realized One knows feelings as they arise, as they remain, and as they go away. He knows perceptions as they arise, as they remain, and as they go away. He knows thoughts as they arise, as they remain, and as they go away. This too you should remember as an incredible and amazing quality of the Realized One." And Ananda responded, "Sir, the Buddha knows feelings as they arise, as they remain, and as they go away. He knows perceptions as they arise, as they remain, and as they go away. He knows thoughts as they arise, as they remain, and as they go away. This too I remember as an incredible and amazing quality of the Buddha." That's what Ananda said, and the teacher approved, satisfied those mendicants were happy with what the Venerable Ananda said. Okay, so for all of the mothers in this room, I'm sure, was that experience of childbirth very much like your own experience? Or no? I'll take that as a no then. Okay, so here we have a story which is, you know, obviously, you know, quite elaborated with a lot of mythical ideas, and if we were to ask of all of those things, which ones are likely to be have actually happened, there is one sutta elsewhere in the Anguttara Nikaya that also talks about the Buddha's birth, and in that sutta Also with Ananda, Ananda remarks on how the Buddha's mother passed away after only 7 days after he was born. And so it's interesting that that detail is like in a very short sutta, and that this is a very realistic human detail, because we know that, of course, maternal death after childbirth is actually very sadly very common in the world. It still is today, obviously it's a lot less so, but in those days it was quite common. And we know that the Buddha was brought up by his auntie, Mahaprajapati. So the idea that the Buddha's mother passed away shortly after he died seems quite likely to have been historically the case. As for all of those other things, the galaxy shaking and trembling and so on, I can't verify those things, so we'll just have to take that as being part of the story, perhaps, perhaps not. But as a general idea, what this kind of story or this kind of mythology is saying is that there is something which is special about this birth, obviously, but more than just something being special about this birth, but the birth in some way is an intrusion or is a break from the cycle of birth and aging and death. And this kind of idea most commonly is expressed through, in mythology is very widespread, almost universal, most commonly expressed through the idea of the virgin birth. And of course you're familiar with anyone from Jesus to Anakin Skywalker is born in this way. And so this is the basic idea, is that there's something happening which is incredible and special and which is going to change the world. Right. Now, so how do we read this as practitioners or as people who are interested in the Buddhist path? Of course, the Buddha said some of the very first teachings that he gave in the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta in his first discourse is jati pi dukkha, birth is suffering. Yeah? Birth is suffering. And the whole point of Buddhism is to escape from rebirth. So the idea in Buddhism is that birth happens, and it doesn't just happen once. It keeps on going. And when you die, that's not the end. When you die, the actions that you've done create the conditions for another rebirth and another stage of life. And then you go through the whole thing again. And when you get reborn in the next life, then you also start making choices and doing things in that life which are going to push you into another one. And you keep on going from one to the other. So the Buddha said we should try to practice to end this cycle. That when the Buddha called samsara. So from that perspective, from that doctrinal perspective of Buddhism, then Buddhism has a negative idea of birth. Okay? We want to make an end of birth, old age and death. And the reason that you have a negative opinion of birth is because it's intrinsically bound up with all of those other things. If you get born, you're going to get old, you're going to suffer, you're going to die. And the Buddha said there is something better. The practice of Dhamma and the realization of freedom is something which is better. So on the one hand, we have this idea that we're going to escape from rebirth. But on the other hand, if the Buddha hadn't been born, then none of this would have happened. And more generally speaking, if none of you had been born, then we wouldn't be here. Right? So it's not like birth is sort of an unequivocally a bad thing. Right? Birth is just part of nature. But it does entail suffering. And so because of that, this is in this particular discourse, you see this kind of tension between these ideas. Like on the one hand, we have to acknowledge that rebirth is suffering and entails suffering, but at the same time, we want to celebrate the Buddha's birth, and at the same time, we don't want to kind of celebrate it too much.
Well,
I suppose they went a bit over the top, right? Now, I'll just make a few remarks just on the text before we go any further. First thing to note is that this is a dialogue with Venerable Ananda, and Venerable Ananda, of course, was the student who was most intimate with the Buddha and was the most concerned with the Buddha's life and his personal life story. And in fact, I believe that most of what we know today about the Buddha's life story comes through Ananda. So it's quite typical that he's being depicted here as being the one who's carrying on this conversation. In the translation, the text uses the word bodhisattva, which you may be more familiar with in the Sanskrit form, which is bodhisattva. And bodhisattva, well, can someone tell me what bodhisattva means?
On the path.
Sorry?
On the path.
Bodhisattva means on the path. Anyone else?
Oh, it's a way of being which decided not to go to Nirvana, but to remain in samsara, to help other beings to wake up.
Okay, thank you. Yeah, good. The back, yeah?
According to Tibetan Buddhism, who makes the wish back until all beings are liberated.
Right.
It's quite a high standard.
Yeah, someone who wants to make the wish to come back and reborn to liberate all sentient beings. So this is the meaning of the word bodhisattva, which it has in later forms of Buddhism. But in the suttas, in the early suttas, it doesn't mean that. And so this is one of those words which is important to be clear about what exactly that we're talking about. In the early suttas, the word bodhisattva means one who is intent on awakening. Right. So this idea that the bodhisattva has renounced awakening and so on, that's not what it's meaning when it's using the word here. Normally, in the suttas, the word bodhisattva is used only for the period of the 6 years after Siddhartha leaves his home before he becomes enlightened. Right? And that's really what it means. It means it's the one who's out there doing the hard work to get enlightened. And this is the only context where it's actually applied earlier, or one or two contexts where it's applied earlier. So this is applied from the beginning of the Buddha's life and even into his past life. So it's a very unusual usage, and it's one of the signs that this is a later development of this particular sutta. But what's interesting, so that's just like a historical note for when you're reading the suttas, it's important to be aware that these doctrines evolved and changed over time. So when you're reading one particular kind of literature, then you have to know how the words are used in that particular place, because they're not used in the same meaning in different kinds of literature. The interesting thing about here is that Ananda's first words are mindful and aware. Right? This is the first thing that Ananda mentions: mindful and aware, sato sampajano. The Buddha is reborn in his past life and passes away and gets reborn in his life and so on. So what's actually happening with that? Well, of course, this is this idea that if somebody has a high level of spiritual development, then when you pass away, if you're mindful and your mind is clear, then you can keep that mindfulness through that process of rebirth. Right? This is what this is alluding to. Now, obviously, if it's talking about the being who was to become the Buddha, then you're talking about a very high level of spiritual development, and so the assumption or the idea is that he's fully aware of that process as he goes through it. Okay? And the nice thing about this, and one of the things I like the most about this particular sutta, is if you skip all through Ananda's amazing stuff, and you come back to what the Buddha says at the end, the Buddha says, well, what's actually amazing about me is that I know my thoughts and my perceptions and my feelings. That's pretty amazing, right? Yeah? And it's very sly. Yeah? So the Buddha's not saying, okay, Ananda, just sort of calm down with all of this stuff, right? Don't get too excited with all these kind of lights appearing and devas and all of that stuff. That's all the magic tricks. Right? But the real important thing is that the Buddha is aware of his thoughts, feelings and perceptions. And what's not made explicit in this sutta, but which you can learn from elsewhere in the suttas, is that that particular practice that the Buddha mentions at the end, right, being aware of thoughts as they arise, as they persist and as they pass away, being aware of feelings, being aware of perceptions as they arise and persist and pass away, that practice leads to what? Specifically, it leads to mindfulness and full awareness, sati and sampajanya. In other words, the practice that the Buddha says at the end is precisely what leads to the first qualities mentioned by Ananda at the beginning. You see? See the structure of it? So the Buddha's not saying that the amazing thing about the Buddha is not what all of these things that happened to him, but about what he did, about how he practiced. And it's because of his practice that all of these things can happen. That's clear? Yeah? Okay. Alright, so now I don't want to talk too much about all of those different kind of amazing and kind of miraculous things that's going on there, but please, if there's anything that happened there that you were like, what, hang on, what's that? Then please speak up and ask. But I'm just going to mention a couple of things. First of all, the coolest one, of course, is when the light appears throughout all of the galaxies and the whole galaxy shakes. But even cooler than that bit is the bit where the sentient beings reborn in the interstellar space will be illuminated by that light and that they'll recognize each other. So this means that there are not just aliens living on other planets, right? Here we're talking about some kind of beings that are living in the middle of interstellar space. And to that I have only two words to say, Boltzmann brains. Does anyone know what Boltzmann brains are? No?
No?
No? Oh, you don't know what Boltzmann brains are. Okay, let me explain what Boltzmann brains are. Would you like to know? Okay, Boltzmann brains. Boltzmann brains are an actual thing. I can Google it for you if you like. I'm not just making this thing up. But Boltzmann brains are a speculation in quantum theory. Now, in quantum theory, they have this idea that a particle can just manifest in a vacuum and then disappear. So it just pops into existence and then pops out of existence. Now the problem is that if one particle can pop into existence and pop out of existence, the probability of that is very small, but it happens. But if one particle can do it, then two particles can pop into existence next to each other, boop, and then disappear. It's very, very unlikely, but given how big the universe is, it happens. And if two particles can do it, three can. And if three can do it, a whole brain can pop into existence out of nothing and float around in the middle of interstellar space. This is called a Boltzmann brain. And if you run the math, the probability works out. You know, it's incredibly, unbelievably unlikely that this would ever happen. But space is even incredibly bigger than that. So the likelihood is that there are Boltzmann brains out there. And not just some. Given how big space is, it's quite possible that there's more Boltzmann brains than there are regular brains. So the normal kind of brain in the universe is this spontaneously manifested brain that's floating around in the middle of the interstellar space. That's the normal form of life in the universe.
How do you spell that?
Boltzmann, B-O-L-T-Z-M-A-N, I guess. Boltzmann, something like that.
Two ends,
is it? Thank you. So, is that what the Buddha's talking about here? You see, you read this, you thought that seemed completely incredible, but then, well, now it's science, so it must be true. So whether this is like literally referring to Boltzmann brains or not, I confess, I do not know. But what is interesting about it is just that kind of it takes for granted that idea that there is life all over the place, right? That there is life everywhere through the galaxy. And the symbolic meaning of this is that the birth of the Buddha is of such significance that it shakes to the foundations our assumptions about what life is and what matters in life. Right? This is the metaphorical meaning, the mythological meaning. Right? The whole universe is shaken because this being has appeared who's undermining and going to question the basic assumptions on which all life matters. And of course that basic assumption is that birth is good. Life is good. Right? And the Buddha's coming along and saying, hang on, you're born, you're going to suffer. And maybe there's something else. Anyway. So the other bit which is obviously very symbolic is when the Bodhisattva he's born, and as soon as he's born he stands firm with his own feet on the ground. I can't help thinking this must have been a big shock to all of the people who were there. Imagine like the midwives, and for this, according to the tradition, then this event happened while Buddha's mother was on a journey. This also is quite a plausible detail, because it's quite an accepted custom in those parts that when a woman came close to the time of giving birth, that she would go back to her family home from the husband's home, go back to her home for the birth. And so, according to the tradition, she was travelling back from Maya was travelling back from Kapilavastu to her home in Devadaha, and then gave birth along the way at not Devadaha, sorry, that's someone else. Where is Maya's birthplace? Sorry?
She gave birth
at Lumbini, yeah. Maya's birthplace is... Sorry, Maya's hometown is... Oh, escaped me at the moment. Anyway, so she gave birth on the journey. Of course, this also is very significant. And you think many of the different heroes, like Jesus, gave birth on a journey and so on and so forth. It's another one of these mythic motifs. I won't go too much into the mythological significance of it now, but anyway, she's there, she's holding onto a tree, the sal tree, she gives birth, and Bodhisattva stands on his feet. Everyone's like, what's going on here? Facing north. And then all of this passage is very, very deeply doctrinally significant. So when he stands on his own two feet, then this is a sign that he will become enlightened through his own practice and own endeavours. Then facing north, the word uttara in Pali means the beyond. So the word north and beyond mean the same thing. So in other words, facing the beyond, facing the transcendent, facing the north. He takes seven strides. So the seven strides can be interpreted doctrinally as being the seven factors of awakening. But more, I think a better reading of that is that it's meant mythologically or symbolically. In mythology, the number seven is very common, and typically the number seven symbolizes the entire cycle of creation. This is the basic idea of the number seven, because it's represented by the seven planets and different kinds of things like that, so in the 7 days of the week and so on. So the idea of like the whole cycle of life. So he's facing beyond and taking the seven strides across the whole cycle of life with a white parasol held above him. Yeah, so the white parasol, again, the sign of royalty and dignity, surveys all of the quarters, indication of his all-encompassing knowledge, and then makes this dramatic statement. When I'm reading this, the language is highly emphatic here. I should even make it more emphatic in the translation, I think. Facing north, he takes seven strides with a white parasol. In fact, the Pali word is Sattapada Vikihara. That's a very special word. It means something like take seven mighty strides, something like that. And then, I am the foremost in the world, I am the eldest in the world, I am the best in the world. All right. So, all right. Okay, so one of the things that this story does is it dramatizes this moment, and because it's dramatizing this moment, as part of a narrative, it doesn't feel the need to resolve these dilemmas. So I mentioned before, we have that dilemma that on the one hand, life is good, we wouldn't be here without life, we enjoy it, we're happy, we're better off alive than dead. At the same time, we want to escape from it. And there's this tension in the Buddhism and the Buddhist path between these two aspects. And that tension is felt throughout the Buddha's life. For example, later on in the Buddha's life, when he wanted to go forth, did he stay home with his family or did he go forth? And it's the same kind of tension. And here, as a kind of narrative, and it's kind of playing with this kind of thing because it's celebrating that act of birth, at the same time it's distancing the birth of the Buddha from an ordinary biological birth. I mean, it's not messy and painful and dangerous like a messy biological birth. Although, well, Maya did die, so I guess it still was dangerous. And all of these are, of course, issues and questions which face all of us. And, you know, as a monk, then I've made my choice. You know, I'm not starting a family in this life, and that's my choice. And I'm going to practice the Dhamma as best I can, and hopefully I'll get enlightened. Everybody here in this room has their own choice to make, and everybody here will be making a different choice, or for complex reasons that often we can't understand. Then, of course, one of the issues that we face today is that into that mix we then throw climate change, and we throw the fact that there is not a negligible possibility that any children that we have will not live to be very old, or that they'll live in a world that is drastically less amenable than the world that we've known. A few days ago, I read an article in The Guardian, which I would like to read for you. And I'll just read it for you first before giving any comments, by a lady called Gemma Carey, who is, if I'm not mistaken, a lecturer or something at a university in Sydney. She wrote an article, it was in The Guardian a few days ago, actually it was appeared on The Guardian on Christmas Day. If I have no hope for the planet, why am I so determined to have this baby? I wonder if my child will ever have the innocence I had 2 months ago of not having to think about whether the air will kill you. And she begins the article, sitting nauseous with morning sickness on a park bench in the bright heat of an unusually hot spring day. My partner and I watched children march past us, striking from school. What's the point of an education if we have no future, their signs say. My heart relocates itself, sinking down somewhere around my ankles. They have 10 years more of inhabitable planet than the baby I'm carrying. In early summer of the same year, after a miscarriage, I found myself pregnant again in the week that megafires tear through the state. There are 70-meter flames producing their own weather systems, driving them further on across the countryside, through the bushland that relies on fire to stimulate new life onto forests that have never before been burnt. The sky over our Canberra home is tinged orange. The air is thick and sticks in the back of your throat in such a way that no coughing seems to dislodge the sensation. The whole country is suffocating. We haven't seen the sky in a month. Outside, the particle count is only 200 parts per million. Yesterday it was 700, more than double the highest warning of hazardous. 2 months ago, we'd never looked at fine particle readings. We didn't know the difference between a 10 micrometer particle that can be filtered out by your respiratory system and one smaller than 2.5 micrometers that will find its way right into your bloodstream. I wonder if my child will ever have the innocence I had 2 months ago of not having to think about whether the air will kill you. Locked in my house, waiting for a high-grade pollution mask to arrive by post, I press my nose up against the glass doors, looking at where my front fence should be. So, this is what it's like to have a baby at the end of the world. There's always a leap of faith in choosing to have a child. Will they be healthy? Can you provide for them? Will you be a good parent? Will you even know how to be a parent? We have to suspend our own disbelief in ourselves. We can do this. I can do this. There are times in history when that leap has been more existential. I can only imagine that women anxiously questioned what world we left for my child during the Cold War, during epidemics, during genocide. And I presume they continued because, despite the terror, they still had hope. Hope that the atrocities of humanity, the threat of disease, would quiet. Hope that their child would be one of the lucky ones. How different is this existential leap to the one women must take now, to quiet their minds as the world burns? In some ways, the threat is both more abstract and more overwhelming. War is an immediate threat to life, but war can stop as abruptly as it starts. Climate collapse is less immediate. There is, at least presently, and for most of us, no imminent loss of life. But unlike war, it cannot be stopped. Perhaps it can be slowed. Maybe a little of the damage already done could be mitigated. But as my climate researcher friend explained to me this year, there's an analogy we use to explain climate change to students. We say it's like traffic. You're not in traffic. You are traffic. I lost two babies in 2019. With each loss, I both grieved and felt something lift from my chest. What is it lifting? I searched. Why is there the smallest touch of relief each time this happens? I dug. Guilt was the answer. It was guilt sitting on my chest while I was pregnant that sits there now while I write pregnant again. Guilt for creating another human that has to live on this planet. Guilt for my own unborn child that they will not live the kind of comfortable life that I have. That the things that we know we can pass on to protect our children from suffering that previous generations have sought to pass on will do little. Education, wisdom, wealth are useless when there's no air. When I expressed this guilt, or rather its dispersion after I lost babies, friends would say, don't feel climate guilt. We need a smart, informed generation if we're going to get out of this. Or it's kids like yours, like mine, that are going to change things. In these comments, I see the hope that they're reaching for, the way they quiet their mind when they worry. What world will be left for my child, as countless women before them have? I envy them that hope. Maybe it will be the straw I too cling to when I finally do bring a child into this world. I nod as they talk, perhaps more to themselves than to me, and stop words leaving my lips. Thinking your child will be part of the solution, not the problem, is hubris. We are the collapse. Our children are the collapse. Why, might you ask, if I think my child could be part of the solution is merely self-soothing hubris, do I keep getting pregnant? Why, if I have no hope like my friends, am I so determined that I've now become pregnant for the third time in a year? There are two answers to this. One is that I hope the hope will come. The other is that in choosing between the sadness of living a child-free existence, because I do not believe the earth can survive us, and the sadness of having a child whose future may be limited, I choose the latter. When I weigh them up, hold each in my mind and my hands and see which is heavier, I decide time and again that the latter is a heaviness, a sadness I can more easily carry. I think of my child, of the relationship I will have with them and the world we will live in, like the time my mother was terminally ill. When my mother had cancer, there was 12 months between her diagnosis and her death. I knew she would die. But knowing that didn't mean I didn't spend time with her, didn't laugh with her, find joy and beauty in our relationship, enjoy the experiences we could have while we had time. And so it is we must reach for the pieces of beauty the world still offers us. The clear blue sky when we have it, a child watching a bee feeding in the garden, the sounds of a flock of native birds passing overhead. We, my child-to-be and I, will visit the world on its deathbed. When I read that up, I was very, very deeply moved. I hope that that spoke something to you as well. One of the things that really came across to me in that piece of writing was about how that response was just a very human one. And it's something that I have been looking for and trying to do myself and trying to be looked for in others. So often when I read about or when I speak to people about these things, I hear people coming with their moralistic judgments about what's right and what's wrong, what we should be doing, what we shouldn't be doing. Or I hear political criticisms and accusations about how we've got in this situation. Or I hear like a kind of an activist agenda, like somebody trying to present things in a way to make me do something. And I didn't hear any of those things in that writing. I heard of a human being who's making a difficult decision for very kind of heartfelt and very meaningful reasons. And I thought there was something really honest and very moving about that. Of course, the world being what it is, she was immediately attacked on Twitter. These horrible people who are criticizing her for having a baby. And many of the people who are criticizing her were, or one group of people were, what they call the anti-natalists. I don't know, have you heard of anti-natalists? Mm-hmm. No? So this is a kind of a movement, contemporary movement of people who basically have decided that birth is bad. So we shouldn't have it anymore. No more babies. Humans have proven themselves unworthy and we shouldn't have babies anymore. And like many of these kind of contemporary kind of movements, people get really energetic in promoting their particular point of view. And the philosophical root of it is seems to be rooted in negative utilitarianism, that is, in the idea that the greatest good is the elimination of suffering. So normally positive utilitarianism is that the greatest good is the greatest happiness for the greatest number. But negative utilitarianism says that what's good is to avoid suffering. And so the best way to avoid suffering is to just not be here. And if there aren't any people to suffer, then there's not going to be any suffering. It makes sense, right? Of course, that particular point of view is the moderate form of antinatalism. A more extreme form says it's not just human beings who shouldn't be here, but life itself shouldn't be here, because even if there's nature is still here, then nature's still suffering. So it's best off if we just leave a sterile, dead planet in a sterile, dead universe. That's the best. That's the only way we can be sure. Just nuke it all. And I mean, on the surface, right? That point of view on the surface. I mean, they're talking about getting rid of suffering. The Buddha was talking about getting rid of suffering. They're talking about that birth is something that we should get away from. But the Buddha said the same thing. We should get away from rebirth. What's actually different about the antinatalist view and the Buddhist view?
You have to work for it.
Well, I'm sure antinatalists would say they have to work for it as well.
Choice.
Maybe, yeah.
There's no birth in the human form until they explain to the mother form.
Well, that's part of it, right? So the Buddhist point of view would say that attempt is doomed because rebirth will take place in different realms anyway. Okay? So that I think that's true, but I think it's also not quite getting the point, right? Because it's not just that antenatalist view doesn't sound just like it's ineffective. It sounds like there's something wrong with it. Right? There's something disturbingly wrong with it.
There's no liberation in this, is there?
There's no liberation in it? Yeah?
It's just destructive.
Yeah?
It's like making other people do the choice rather than working on your own path.
Okay. Yes, in this case it was, but you could say it may not necessarily be that, right? You could still make antinatalism a personal choice. You should say, well, from my point of view, this is what I want to do. So I don't think it necessarily involves coercion. Right. Right, and in future generations as well. Yeah? For our future generations to make their choices. There's something about that idea which is as a moral philosopher, then one of the problems that I have with that idea is more of a general problem with moral philosophy is that moral philosophy is highly uncertain. Right? It's not physics. Right? I mean, we basically don't really have any idea about what the fundamental meaning of right and wrong is. I mean, is something right and wrong because, like I mentioned, that utilitarian view, because it creates happiness or suffering, or is it because it is just there's something intrinsic in the universe that makes it right or wrong, or is it because it's something that human agrees is right and wrong? And the whole field of moral philosophy is so uncertain that to take one particular viewpoint and then just impose it in that way, this kind of absolutist approach to it, is you always end up with something which sounds as horrifying as that antinatalist view. And the reason I'm bringing this up and the reason I'm mentioning it is because I found among Buddhists that it's all too easy to fall into this kind of view. And that people will say something like, oh well, we deserved it. Oh well, it's suffering anyway. Oh well, we should practice and get out of it. And that kind of view or that idea, which is driven by a doctrine, driven by an idea about what Buddhist philosophy is, and being driven by that idea about Buddhist philosophy it somehow cuts you off from human experience and from the reality of people's lives. And so instead of our spiritual practice making our hearts grow so that we can empathize and understand and have compassion for people, our spiritual practice or our spiritual doctrine can serve the other way of cutting off that concern for others. Okay? And this is the kind of defense mechanism, right? We can use our doctrine to make those things go away. People who follow religious paths do this kind of thing all the time. In Christianity, you say, oh, it's God's will that this happen. Yeah? Or you're like when the hurricane hit Puerto Rico. And, you know, it's so devastating. Thousands of people died, and there was this horrifying preacher in Florida who said it's because of all the lesbians. You know, cause and effect, right? You allow same-sex marriage, and then what next thing, there's this hurricane wrecking Puerto Rico. I mean, it's obvious, right? But, of course, no such thing as man-made climate change. That wouldn't be real. So no matter what your doctrine or your belief or your philosophy is, if your philosophy, if the concept and the ideas of your philosophy are allowed to drive your mind too far, then you cut yourself off from your humanity. And I think, like, I think that antinatalist view, I think, is horrifying, right? But at the same time, they've got a point, and there's certainly a point to considering: should we be having babies? And I don't think that this is something that there's an answer to. And this is why, you know, when you heard that Jenna Carey speaking, she came to this idea that, well, even if it's only a short amount of life, then surely that's something that we can celebrate. I mean, even a normal life, we can't determine. Like, you know, if you have a baby, you hope your baby will live a long and happy life. But we can't say that. But even what we have, then that's something which can be beautiful and can be celebrated. And that example that she gave about the time that she spent with her mother. And so I think these are kinds of challenges that all of us are going to be facing as time goes on. And we're going to be facing the judgment, like she talked in there about the judgment from her friends, or the different ways that different people will respond to it. But at the end of the day, we have to make our own choices. What we are here, we've been born, what is the significance of that? When the Buddha was born, was the significant thing that the earthquakes came and the galaxy shook and there was light everywhere and all of those things? Yeah. The thing that the Buddha pointed to was his practice, and his practice of meditation. That's the thing that he thought was really valuable about his life, about his birth. The thing that was really valuable about the Buddha's birth was that he brought that practice of mindfulness to us. That's why we celebrate the Buddha's life. Because yes, birth is suffering, aging suffering, sickness is suffering. Thanks for it.
So my question is, yeah. Everything in life you can see as suffering but also as a bliss.
Right, yeah.
So it depends how you label it yourself.
Yeah.
And I think it would be very useful that we start to have a dialogue with our own minds and to be in charge of our own minds. Because the mind doesn't really make a difference between good and bad unless you give it the significance, good or bad. The mind always does what you want it to do, I feel.
The mind always does what you want it to do?
Yes. I would rephrase. I strongly believe you can be in charge of your own mind. For example, if you go to the supermarket and there is a line in front of you and they would say, you know, look at me, I'm in the line, and why me, and stuff like that. But you can also turn it around again and say, you know, I'm blessed to be in the line because I'm able to buy food. So you can always be in charge of that. So I think it could be very useful to have a dialogue with your mind, because the mind eventually will do what you tell the mind to do.
Yeah, I'm not so sure that the mind will do what you tell it to do, but your point is well taken, that the way that we relate to our experience is fundamentally important, so we can shift our perception and the way that we see things. And in a way, that's what I was trying to get at with this idea of birth, that it's not something which birth itself ultimately is, and it's just the reality, it's how we are. And there are ways of looking at it that it's suffering, ways of looking at it that it's joyful. Actually, it's both of those things. Or you could say it's neither of those things, because all of those things are just things that we've originated in our minds. But the reality for us is that we are here. We have been born. And in being born, we're not fundamentally different from the Buddha. Okay, I mean, yeah, there's a few differences of details in the process of birth, as we heard, right? But the basic idea is still the same. We're born and we're here. And we come into this world. And the Buddha had a choice to make. Yeah? Was he going to live at home? Was he going to do that? Was he going to go the spiritual path and become enlightened? His getting enlightened wasn't destiny, it wasn't something that was foreordained. It was something that came out of how he chose to live his life.
According to the story, it wasn't destiny, because he was standing and strides seven
times. Right, this is true. This is true. Textually, yes, that's true. In terms of actually his life, I don't think that is the case. I don't think he really... I personally don't think he really did that. I think someone made that up. And I think most likely when he was born, he probably lay down and went... Nyeh. That's my guess. I wasn't there, so I can't say 100%. So don't quote me on this. But... according to the way that the mythology works, see one of the essential features of mythology, the basic theme of mythology is these things never were but are always. They make the story after, and the story tells of what came before, but the story came after, and so the whole thing is a big cycle. Yeah, it's a big circle. So they knew. The storytellers knew what was going to happen. Right? And so for them, this was something that was always going to happen. But that's a feature of the mythic mode of storytelling. As far as the Buddha's life, if we look at other events in his life, in the coming days, we'll be looking at the Buddha's descriptions of his meditation practice and other events in his life, and we'll see that those events are often told in much more realistic terms. And in those cases, it's very clear that he's doing this because this is a practice that he wants to do to overcome suffering. So I guess the point of this all is that here we are. We are in this life. We've been born. We didn't necessarily get a choice in it, in the matter. And if you feel annoyed that you didn't get a choice in the matter, then you should take that up with the appropriate authorities. And meanwhile, however, we are here and we've got to make the best of it. So how are we going to live? What choices are we going to make? And especially what Gemma Carey said in that, when she doesn't have any hope. She didn't go into any reasons why she doesn't have hope. But what was really interesting to me was that she's going ahead and living anyway. Whether you have hope or not, it seems to me, is beside the point. And if you know, even like how you assess or how you understand the climate crisis or whatever, you might think that this is just way too excessive and that things are much more uncertain, we have a good chance of surviving and all of those things. Maybe that may be true. It's just, at the end of the day, it's really just probability. We can't predict the future. But still, regardless of all of those, it seems to me that none of those things are quite hitting the point. No, the point is that what kind of person do you want to be? What kind of life do you want to lead? What is the right thing to do? And at the end of the day, whether you have hope or not is a bit beside the point. If you get up in the morning, you think, I don't have any hope, but how do you want to live that day? What kind of choices do you want to make? What kind of person do you want to be? And so these kinds of dangers and threats and crises that come to us, then they bring those things into sharp relief. And they cause us to ask these questions. So I'm going to leave you just with that for this evening. And hopefully we'll encourage some existential anxiety. And we'll see how we go with that. Yeah. Right. So I'll finish up there because it's getting a bit late, and I'll see you back here tomorrow morning.